Hello and welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of Chapter 2 from NASM's Certified Personal Trainer course. My name is Eddie Lester and I'll be taking you through this lecture today. And I want to get started by talking about how Chapter 2 is really in-depth, has a lot of exercise science information, but when it comes down to it, there's only about two or so questions on the test from this chapter. But you do need to know a lot of information for the field. So what we'll do as we go through this PowerPoint lecture today is we'll talk about the importance of knowing this stuff for the field, and I'll try to point out those specific things, and then we'll also point out some of the test questions that are very likely to be on the test. So let's go ahead and look at our screen above, the PowerPoint presentation. We're on slide 1 of 46. So starting off, Chapter 2 is called Basic Exercise Science. Let's go ahead and click over to slide 2. The objectives for this chapter is to be able to explain the basic structure and function of the nervous system, skeletal system, muscular system, and endocrine system, and also see how these systems respond and adapt to exercise. So moving over to slide 3, we're talking about the human movement system as the first topic. And mainly the human movement system is going to be a combination of three systems: the nervous system, the muscular system, and the skeletal system. And you need all of those systems to promote human movement, in the sense that the nervous system controls the muscular system, which the muscular system then pulls on bones that have joints that create movement. So these systems work in concert to produce human movement, and all components must work together to produce proper movement. And if one component is not working well, it will affect all others because of the kinetic chain. And the kinetic chain, when we talk about that, is basically a link of your joints, muscles, and the nervous system from the feet all the way up to the head. So looking at slide 4, it specifically goes over the kinetic chain. Kinetic means forces or motion, and chain refers to a system linked together or connected. And all components work together to manipulate human motion. If one component of the kinetic chain is not working properly, it will affect all others and ultimately affect the movement. And when it says it affect the movement, it'll affect the proper posture and proper movement pattern that they're talking about. So for instance, if we have, you know, really tight calves, which affects our dorsiflexion, that's going to be affected all the way up through the kinetic chain when we do something like a squat. And we'll get into the exact parameters around what's called the overhead squat assessment to assess posture, but those are the types of kinetic chain impairments that we're looking for. So once again, the kinetic chain, they say, is made up of the nervous system, muscular system, and skeletal system. And let's go ahead and click over to slide 5. All right, the nervous system is one of the many organ systems of the body and contains specialized cells that transmit and coordinate signals, providing a communication network within the body. The nervous system is comprised of two main components, the CNS and the PNS. So the CNS is going to be composed of the brain and spinal cord, and that is known as the central nervous system. And the peripheral nervous system is the PNS, and it's basically all other nerves that transmit signals throughout the body. So that is important to know, just to understand the way that the nervous system works, is that the brain and spinal cord are the control centers, and then the peripheral nervous system is going to be all the other nerves in which transmit communication signals. So looking on to slide 6, the nervous system is a communication network in the body. It allows us to gather information about the internal and external environment, process and interpret that information, and then respond. And the way that we do that is through the sensory nervous system, the integrative nervous system, and the motor nervous system. So moving on to slide 7, the nervous system, sensory nervous system is going to be able, the ability of the nervous system to sense changes in internal or external environment. So sensory information is going to be transmitted from your nerves or peripheral nervous system to your brain and spinal cord. Where it is integrated, or the integrative area, is going to be the ability of the nervous system to analyze and interpret the sensory information to allow for proper decision making. And then to produce the motor response, or to produce the appropriate response, that is the motor nervous system, or the neuromuscular response to the sensory information. So the sensory information, like let's say we're looking at, or we touch something sharp, that sends a signal up through our peripheral nervous system or our nerves up to our brain and spinal cord, in which we integrate that as pain, and then our motor nervous system says, hey, dummy, move your hand away from the thing that is sharp. And looking on to slide 8, we go over proprioception next. I do want you to know the definition of proprioception, which is the cumulative neural input of all sensory receptors to the central nervous system. And that's mainly all you need to know. Also, they talk about proprioceptive training a lot, and that is going to be focused on like a balance training or a coordination training. But to read the proprioception bullet point, the proprioception is the body's ability to sense the relative position of adjacent body parts, or like the body's awareness in space. And on the test, they define proprioception as the cumulative neural input for all sensory afferents to the central nervous system. Training the body's proprioceptive abilities will improve balance, coordination, posture, and enable the body to adapt to its surroundings without consciously thinking about movement. It's important to train the nervous system efficiently to ensure for proper movement patterns, which can enhance performance and decrease the risk of injury. So moving on to slide 9, the title is the nervous system. And movement is a response to our sensory information and therefore is dictated by the nervous system. This reflects the importance of training in a multisensory environment using different balance tools, for instance, like a Bosu ball, balance pad, DynaDisc, or any sort of other balance tool. And the most efficient or effective way to create positive long-term results in a client is to directly affect his or her nervous system. One fun fact is that in the beginning of all your future clients' training, they're going to have a very quick adaptation from their nervous system. And this might come in the sense of, hey, the first time they can do, you know, 5 push-ups in a row, or they can lift X amount of weight, and then all of a sudden the next week or something, they can do double the amount. That typically means that the nervous system has quickly adapted to that movement pattern, and is not quite means that they have increased strength. It just means that or increased muscle size, they have just trained their nervous system to be efficient at that movement. And the nervous system adapts really, really quickly. So moving on to slide 10, we're talking about the functional unit of the nervous system, which is going to be the neuron. And the neuron is composed of cell body, axon, and dendrites. And specifically, the cell body is like has the nucleus, where the cell more or less produces energy, with mitochondria, lysosomes, Golgi complex. And then the axon is going to be the communication cord, more or less, with the dendrites gathering information from other structures of the body or gathering information from other neurons sometimes, and in that sense. Moving on to slide 11, more about the neuron. You have different types of neurons, and there's sensory neurons, there's motor neurons, and there's interneurons. So sensory neurons are going to transmit impulses that sense our surroundings, for instance, heat or pain or pressure, different things like that. The motor neuron is going to send signals from the brain out to the body. They say like muscles and organs to create movement. And the interneuron is going to transmit nerve impulses from one neuron to another. So kind of like a quick neuron-to-neuron communication. So looking at slide 12, we have the central nervous system. This consists of the brain and spinal cord. That's pretty much all you need to know. Moving on to slide 13, peripheral nervous system is every other nerve in the body that's not the brain and spinal cord. So they say you have 12 pairs of cranial nerves and 31 pairs of spinal nerves. And the function of those is to provide a connection for the nervous system to activate different bodily organs, such as muscles or organs or smooth muscle in the intestines, and also relay information from bodily organs back to the brain to let your body know if there's pain, if there's something wrong, or just that digestion is occurring, or you're full, different things like that. Let's move on to slide 14. So the peripheral nervous system is divided into two other subdivisions, which are known as the autonomic and the somatic. So the somatic nervous system consists of nerves that serve the outer areas of the body and skeletal muscle and are responsible for voluntary control of movement. So that's going to be your voluntary control, conscious nervous system. The autonomic nervous system I like to think is the automatic nervous system, in which it is going to do all of the things that it needs to do without you having to think about it, such as digestion or your heartbeat. So the autonomic is further divided into sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. And this is mainly talking about a hormonal response in the sense that the sympathetic nervous system initiates the fight or flight response, while the parasympathetic initiates rest and digest. And when we're talking about the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, the sympathetic nervous system is what's typically activated during exercise, such as lifting weights, or it's something that might be artificially stimulated by pre-workout to create a fight or flight response, which increases your testosterone, increases your adrenaline production, and the rest and digest is going to more bring you down after exercise. And that's from the parasympathetic nervous system. So moving on to slide 15, we have sensory receptors. It is going to be important to understand a little bit about the different sensory receptors. And mainly we're going to be focused on mechanoreceptors, which are, they respond to mechanical forces such as movement or touch or pressure. But we also have things like the nociceptors that respond to pain, chemoreceptors that respond to taste and smell or chemical interactions, and photoreceptors, which are going to respond to light, like the rods and cones in our eyes. And yeah, we want to focus on those mechanoreceptors. So moving on to slide 16, we have a few mechanoreceptors, which are specifically the muscle spindle, Golgi tendon organ, and then different joint receptors. NASM loves to bring up muscle spindle and Golgi tendon organs on quizzes and tests, and it would be important to know that muscle spindles are sensitive to a change in length and rate of length change in the muscle. And the Golgi tendon organ is going to be sensitive to a change in tension or tension change. So when looking at the muscle spindle, when you're doing a stretch, for instance, stretching your chest or pec major, you're going to be feeling the muscle spindles, or the mechanoreceptor that's feeling that stretch is the muscle spindle. When you add load to something, for instance, like you lift something or bicep curl it, or barbell curl, you sense that change in tension of the muscle via the Golgi tendon organ. So moving on to slide 17, we're going to get now into the skeletal system. And they don't talk much about the skeletal system on the test, so I'm going to go through this a little bit quickly. But the skeletal system is a framework, provides framework and structure for movement, also provides protection. It's a resting ground for muscles, and bones form junctions that are known as joints, which allow for movement. Moving on to slide 18. So we have two different divisions of the skeletal system, similar to the CNS and the PNS in the nervous system. We have the axial skeleton, which is going to be the skull, vertebral column, and rib cage. And then we also have the appendicular skeleton, which is going to be the upper and lower extremities and the pelvic girdle. So like your arms and legs, everything besides your skull, rib cage, and vertebral column. Moving on to slide 19, bone growth. When we talked about, or we're talking about bone growth, we refer to bone growth as remodeling, which occurs throughout our life cycle. Osteoclasts break down old bone tissue, while osteoblasts build up new bone tissue. And these are the specific cells that are associated with bone growth, or the breaking down of old bone. And when we do weight-bearing exercise, we tend to stimulate the osteoblasts. And the osteoblasts are going to build up new bone tissue. So when we're doing a bicep curl, the bicep attaches to the radius and is going to bend the bones ever so slightly when you pick something heavy up. And this is going to be really good for elderly females or even females getting near that menopausal age as they start to lose estrogen and therefore lose bone mass, which lift or doing weight-bearing exercise can assist them in maintaining bone mass by stimulating these osteoblasts. So remodeling is a constant process of these cells, and as children, obviously, osteoblasts are more active, and then as we get older, osteoclasts become more active. But it is possible to keep those osteoblasts plenty active just by doing weight-bearing exercise as we age. Moving on to slide 20, there's different types of bones. The one shown here is a long bone. Really, I'm not going to go into too much about that. You can look that up in your book. One thing to note is that long bones are where red blood cells are created. Moving on to slide 21, we have short bones, such as your carpal bones in your wrist, and they're small and cuboidal or cubical in shape. Moving on to slide 22, we have flat bones, which are thin and protective, like the shoulder blade or the scapula. Moving on to slide 23, we have irregular bones, which are going to be like vertebrae. There's not any other shape that a vertebrae represents, so it's not flat, it's not long, it's very irregular in shape. Moving on to slide 24, we're getting into now the vertebral column, and it is important to know that we have a total of 24 vertebrae, 7 cervical vertebrae, 12 thoracic vertebrae, which include the vertebrae that all ribs attach to, and 5 lumbar vertebrae, which is the lower back region. And then we also have the sacrum and the coccyx, which are fused at the bottom of the spinal column. Moving on to slide 25, they start to talk about joints and the different types of joints and the different way that, or the different joint motions. So, yeah, the joints are specifically defined as one bone that articulates with another. And whenever you hear the word articulates or artic or arthritis or arth, it's going to be referring to a joint. For instance, arthritis means arth, joint, and itis, inflammation. Joint inflammation is what arthritis means. And joint motion is referred to arthrokinematics. There's that arth, which arth means joint, and kinematics means motion, so joint motion. And typically, you'll see in joints different motions like rolling or sliding or spinning. And moving on to slide 26, we're getting into the function of joints. So joints provide bones a means to be manipulated, meaning they provide the ability to allow for movement. They also provide stability, allowing for movement to take place without unwanted movement. And all joints in the human body are linked together. Movement of one joint will directly affect the motions of the other. And that's going to be an important theme as we move on and learn more about movement and exercise. Moving on to slide 27, joint connective tissues. The main joint connective tissue that is going to create decent amount of stability depending on the joint is going to be ligaments. And ligaments connect bone to bone. And they provide a static and dynamic stability as well as proprioception. So when they say they provide proprioception, the ligaments do have sensory receptors in them to tell you that, hey, your joint's either hyperextending or this is a weird motion, and it'll assist you in not pushing the boundaries of that joint motion. So you prevent injury. And joints also have very low vascularity, ligaments have very low vascularity, which means they do not have a lot of blood flow. So to repair them, it's going to take a long time. For instance, if someone has an ACL injury, they're out from anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half, or 6 months to 18 total months for it to recover, and typically requires surgery. All right, moving on to slide 28. We talked about weight-bearing exercise a little bit already, but just here are some types of weight-bearing exercise. Running, lifting weights, calisthenics are weight-bearing. Swimming and cycling are not. The pool creates a zero-gravity environment, which swim sprinting potentially could create a little bit of bone growth as you're pulling as hard as possible. Maybe like uphill as hard as you can, cycling sprints could be considered a little bit weight-bearing, but NASM typically consider those non-weight-bearing. But weight-bearing does help build and maintain bones, muscles, and connective tissues, and also burns a lot of calories. Moving on to slide 29, now we're going to get into the muscular system. And to define the muscular system, muscles generate internal tension that, under control of the nervous system, manipulate bones as far as to produce movement of our body. So the muscular system is also needed to stabilize and complete the cycle of movement production, which is going to be important to know for the test. Moving on to slide 30, we have the structure of skeletal muscle. So the structure of skeletal muscle, what NASM tends to focus on is the layers of connective tissue that surround the different parts of the muscle. So we have two shown in the picture on this slide, which are the epimysium and paramysium. They also have the endomysium, and the epimysium is going to surround the entire muscle belly. So the entire surround or outside of the muscle is the epimysium. The paramysium is going to surround individual muscle fascicles, and then the endomysium is going to surround individual muscle fibers. And what's unique about the connective tissue, or this connective tissue, epimysium, paramysium, and endomysium, is that they're continuations of the tendon. So the white portion at the end of the muscles, where the muscle turns from red to white, that's all the connective tissue that runs through your entire length of the muscle. And we call those the epimysium, paramysium, and endomysium when they get to the muscle body. So moving on to slide 31, we have connective tissue called tendons that attach muscles to bone. So ligaments attach bone to bone, tendons are going to attach a muscle to a bone. And the one that's shown in the picture on slide 31 is going to be the Achilles tendon. And they have very low vascularity as well, meaning they have very little blood supply, which leaves them susceptible to slow repair and slow adaptation, which can lead to a long injury or recovery process. Moving on to slide 32, You have muscle fibers, or what are called muscle cells. So individual muscle fibers run the length of the entire muscle. So in your quadricep, the one muscle fiber can go all the way from the kneecap all the way up through to the top of the femur, or all the way even up in the rectus femoris to the hip flexor, or to the hip. And that is known as a muscle cell. So muscle cells are very, very long and dependent on the muscle, and are basically typically contain components like sarcoplasm. Sarcoplasm is where you're going to store all of your fuel in the muscle cell. So you have you could store glycogen, fats, minerals, and oxygen-binding myoglobin, which is a protein. Yeah, you could. That's where the nuclei are, which control the muscle cell and make sure that it survives. And then we also have the mitochondria, which are going to transform energy from food into energy for the cell to use. And unlike typical cells, though, they have structures called myofibrils, which are going to be the contractile element of the muscle. So moving on to slide 33, the contractile elements. So myofibrils are the contractile elements, or the cylindrical contractile elements, and they contain two myofilaments called actin and myosin. Actin is the thin filament, myosin is the thick filament, which we'll get into on the next slide. But filaments form sections known as sarcomeres, which are located in between the two zigzag lines, or what are called Z lines. If you look over at the picture on the right, you're going to notice some lines going back and forth, kind of like a Z. Those are Z lines. And then a sarcomere is the functional unit of the muscle, much like the neuron is the functional unit of the nervous system. And it lies, yeah, once again, the sarcomere lies in between the two Z lines. Moving on to slide 34, we have the contractile elements of the muscle. So we have two protein structures, which are called tropomyosin and troponin. The reason why those are slightly important is, in order to understand muscular contraction, actin has these two proteins, tropomyosin and troponin. And to read the second bullet point, tropomyosin is located on the actin filament and blocks the myosin binding sites located on the actin filament, keeping myosin from attaching to the actin when the muscle is in a relaxed state. So in order to create muscular contraction, you have to move the tropomyosin off of those binding sites for the myosin heads. Then we have troponin, which is located on the actin filament, and what the troponin does is it's going to move aside the tropomyosin, which is created by calcium. And tropomyosin will when a muscle needs to contract, will move due to the troponin becoming active. So moving on to slide 35, generating muscular force in a muscle, we have the neural activation of muscle, which is what you're going to see on the right is going to be a motor unit. You have the spinal cord, which stems a nerve, and that nerve is innervating a bunch of different muscle cells. And neural activation occurs when a signal is sent down the motor neuron and to all of the cells that the motor unit is attached to, or that neuron is attached to. And essentially for a muscle to manipulate force in either, it is essential for a muscle to manipulate force for either movement or stabilization, as far as neural activation goes. And it's generated by the communication between the nervous system and the muscular system in the motor unit. And the motor unit is going to be a motor neuron and all the muscle fibers in which it connects to. Moving on to slide 36, we have the steps of the neural activation of a muscle cell. So how does the start of a muscle contraction occur? Well, it starts in the nerve, and electrical impulses are transported from the central nervous system down the axon of the neuron. And then step two, when the impulse reaches the end of the axon, which is the end of the axon is going to be the neuromuscular junction where the neuron attaches to the muscle cell. And once the nervous system signal reaches the end of the axon or the axon terminal, chemicals called neurotransmitters are released. And specifically, there's one called acetylcholine, and that's going to be important to know for the test. But neurotransmitters, or step three, neurotransmitters cross the synapse between the neuron and the muscle fiber, transporting the electrical impulse from the nerve to the muscle. The specific neurotransmitter that initiates muscular contraction is acetylcholine. Winky smiley. Number four, acetylcholine, or ACH, falls into the receptor site on the muscle fiber, specifically designed for its attachment. And once attached, ACH stimulates the muscle fiber to go through a series of steps that produce muscular contraction. And what happens is that we have something called the all or nothing law from step six. And that means that if the acetylcholine is transported across the neuromuscular junction, that muscle cell is going to contract with all of the force possible that one cell can produce. If acetylcholine does not hit the other side of the neuromuscular junction, there is zero muscular contraction. And this is where we get the all or nothing law from. Moving on to slide 37, we have something called the sliding filament theory, which is basically the theory on how a muscle shortens. And to read the first bullet point, the proposed process of how the contraction of the filaments within the sarcomere takes place is the sliding filament theory. A sarcomere shortens as a result of the Z lines moving closer together. So remember when we talked about the Z lines a few slides back, the Z lines will move towards each other during the sliding filament theory or contraction of a muscle. And this is known as muscle shortening. So to read the last bullet point, the Z lines converge as the result of myosin heads attaching to the actin filament and asynchronously pulling the actin filament across the myosin. Moving on to slide 38, we have different types of muscle fibers. We have slow twitch fibers and fast twitch fibers, or type 1 and type 2 muscle fibers. Type 1 slow twitch muscles are going to be higher in capillaries, mitochondria, and myoglobin, and they're going to have increased oxygen delivery. The bad thing about that is that they're smaller in size and they produce less force. But what's good is that during endurance work, they're slow to fatigue. So this is the type of muscle fiber that you might use on a or for endurance work as far as the slow twitch muscle fibers. And or like for stabilization. So like your core muscles are going to be a lot of type 1 muscle fiber because they're constantly active as far as stabilizing your core during all movements. Type 2 or fast twitch muscle fibers are lower in capillaries, lower in mitochondria, and lower in myoglobin, and they have decreased oxygen delivery, which means that they aren't going to be very good for endurance, but they are larger in size, they produce a ton of force, and can produce a ton of strength. But unfortunately, that means that they're going to be quick to fatigue, so you can't, you know, lift really heavy weight continuously for, you know, 10 minutes. You can only do, you know, a very few short seconds, anywhere from maybe 10 to 30 seconds of very high intensity heavy lifting. And they are for short-term contractions, meaning like force and power. And what's a fun fact is that most people are genetically predisposed to have either more slow twitch muscle fiber or more fast twitch muscle fiber. Some of the best athletes in the world have great genetics that might allow them to, dependent on the sport, like football, if you have a lot of fast twitch muscle fiber, you might be more successful. If you are an endurance runner, like a marathon runner, you may be more, or you could be better if you are predisposed to have a lot more slow twitch muscle fibers. But what's really good is that the adaptations that occur will allow you to slightly determine which muscle fibers you have more of. For instance, if you train a lot of power and strength, you potentially could increase the number of type 2 muscle fibers. And if you train a lot of endurance, you can promote an increase in more type 1 slow twitch muscle fibers. So looking on to slide 39, muscles as movers, I definitely want you guys to understand the relationship between muscles and movement in the sense that one muscle does not promote a single movement. Or it doesn't work by itself to produce one movement. For instance, in elbow flexion with the bicep curl, the bicep acts as the prime mover while other muscles assist in elbow flexion and stabilization, and then you also have the antagonist which needs to relax. To go over the specific example on slide 39, the agonist muscle acts as a prime mover, which is, for this example, the gluteus maximus is the agonist or prime mover for hip extension. A synergist muscle that assists in hip extension is going to be the hamstring, or to read the bullet point, hamstring and the erector spinae are synergistic with the gluteus maximus during hip extension. And a stabilizer would be something that stabilizes other portions of the body while the prime mover and synergist do their action. So for example, the stabilizer for hip extension would be the core muscles such as the transverse abdominis, internal oblique, multifidus, which stabilize the low back, pelvis, spine, and spine during hip extension. moving on to slide 40, they're going to talk about the endocrine system a little bit. And the thing that's important about the endocrine system is it is your hormonal control of the body. And with the endocrine system, you need to understand that weight loss and muscle gain is very much a hormonal balance game. And to read the bullet point on slide 40, the endocrine system is a system of glands that secrete hormones that control bodily function. It consists of host organs, chemical messengers, target cells in which the hormones act on, and the target cells bind specifically to hormones to create a reaction, and it regulates body functions such as growth, metabolism, and like I said before, like body fat reduction or muscle growth, or bone growth, and also is important because it is as a response to stress. Moving on to slide 41, the primary glands of the endocrine system are like the pituitary gland, which is the master gland, which has anterior, posterior, and intermediate lobes. You also have the hypothalamus, thyroid, and adrenal glands, which all produce specific hormones to create actions throughout the body. Looking at number 42, or slide 42, we have the pituitary gland, which is the master gland, and it controls pretty much all of the other endocrine glands. And specifically, the anterior portion of the pituitary gland secretes growth hormone, prolactin, ACTH, which is adrenocortical stimulating hormone, acts on the adrenal glands. You have thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH. You have follicle stimulating hormone, or FSH, which is specific for reproductive cell growth. And you also have other hormones that would stimulate your sex organs. Intermediate lobe secretes MSH, which is for the skin. And posterior lobe secretes ADH, which is fluid retention, oxytocin for childbirth. Moving on to slide 43, the thyroid gland regulates metabolism. A lot of times, overweight people might have a thyroid gland issue, which could promote even further obesity. Adrenal glands are responsible for the fight or flight hormones, which is epinephrine, or what we call adrenaline, and norepinephrine, which is the counteracting hormone of adrenaline, meaning that it reduces your heart rate, reduces your blood pressure, to where adrenaline is going to stimulate increased heart rate, increased blood pressure, and increased testosterone production. And testosterone is produced in the testes and adrenal glands, and men produce 10 times more than women. So it's important to understand that testosterone is extremely anabolic, and when men produce 10 times more testosterone than women, we have to understand that literally men have 10 times the growth potential in muscle than women do. When women talk about, oh, hey, you know, I really don't want to get too bulky from exercise or weightlifting, it's really, really, really difficult for a woman to get bulky. And typically, if a woman wants to, like, not look like a bodybuilder, as long as they don't do 5 to 10 years of perfect eating with perfect resistance training or strength training, they're not going to be bulky. So it is important to understand that women can totally lift weights, and their likelihood of getting bulky is very, very low due to the fact that they don't produce that much testosterone, which doesn't have as much of an anabolic effect on the muscle. So looking at slide 44, when we talk about blood glucose control or blood glucose regulation, the control of blood glucose levels are regulated by the pancreas, and specifically with the pancreas, it secretes insulin and glucagon. Insulin brings glucose into the cells from the bloodstream, or therefore it decreases blood sugar, and it results in a net drop in blood sugar levels. And glucagon signals the liver and muscles to use glycogen for fuel, or release glycogen to be used as fuel. And this results in a rise in blood sugar. And exercise improves bodily utilization of glucose, which is good. Hormones, just to end, or near the end here, both produced in men and women, testosterone and estrogen are produced as sex hormones. Testosterone is produced 10 times more in men than women, and is secreted by the testes and adrenal glands, which is a major anabolic agent, leading to men having larger muscle growth potentials. Estrogen is produced in the ovaries and adrenal glands, and women produce significantly more estrogen. We also have cortisol, which is produced in the adrenals, and is the main catabolic agent. which catabolism is the breakdown of muscle, and anabolism is going to be the buildup of muscle. So growth hormone is also produced in the pituitary, and a major anabolic agent, typically very active in puberty. And thyroid, which is found in the neck, controls metabolism, and exercise can elevate all of these hormones, which is a good, beneficial thing. So to wrap it up on slide 46, just to summarize what we kind of went over, we went over the nervous system, the muscular system, the skeletal system, and those all work together to produce movement. The nervous system is composed of billions of neurons that transfer information throughout the body through two independent systems, which is the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. Skeletal system is the body's framework for protection and red blood cell production, and also has bones that allows that connect via joints and allows for movement. With the axial and appendicular skeleton. And then the muscular system is made up of many individual fibers attached to bones by way of tendons. Muscles generate force through neural activation, which creates slight or shortening of the muscles, like the sliding filament theory, and excitation-contraction coupling. So, looking further down the page, let's go ahead and make sure that we listen to the audiobook lecture, complete the assignment for this lecture or for this chapter, and then do the chapter quiz. And looking forward to see you at the next chapter with the PowerPoint presentation there.